Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Ariel Waldman. Ariel is an advisor to NASA's Innovative Advanced Concepts program. She led a five-week expedition to Antarctica to film microscopic life under the ice. And you can watch that video series. It's really great. Ariel's the author of the book, What's It Like in Space? Stories from Astronauts Who've Been There, and the global director of Science Hack Day. Hey, Ariel, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks.
It's really wonderful to meet you virtually, and I'm really looking forward to the cool tools you have for us.
Yeah, me too.
Me too, Ariel. Yeah, I've known you for a long time. You're an old friend. I love everything you do, like that. Like I mentioned, that Antarctica series you can watch is really great. What an amazing adventure that was.
Yeah, it was just a lot of fun, and being able to actually film so much of it and get to share it with everyone so that you can really get a peek inside what it's like to spend 5 weeks there. It was just really amazing.
Oh, yeah. And we'll provide links so that people can see that series as well. Let's start with the first pick, which is a certain kind of a microscope. Tell us about what it looks like, how big it is, how much it costs, what you use it for. I'll give us the skinny on it.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is related to going to Antarctica. I have a Nikon E200 LED microscope, which is kind of a basic microscope as things go. It's around, I don't know, $2,000 or so, which is, you know, a bit pricey if you're just wanting to play around for fun. But if you're wanting something as a professional tool, it's rather affordable. And I really love it because it's LED. So a lot of microscopes use halogen bulbs, and they are just really not very fun to play around with because you get a lot of weird sort of lighting artifacts when you have bulbs. So having an actual LED microscope is really nice, and it's really modular, which is the best part of it. So you can spend $2,000 on it, or you can spend like a lot more money on it and sort of soup it out with a lot of different attachments and everything. But having an LED microscope that's a fairly good build quality was fantastic, and it's fairly lightweight as well. So I was able to take it down to Antarctica with me in a Pelican case. And so the majority of all the microscopic critters that I filmed while I was down there was using this microscope.
So if you were to describe it, people kind of have in their head, their mind's eye, a picture of a microscope, you know, from 100 years ago. Is it about the same size and general shape as that, or is it different? And then is it basically the same kind of optical arrangement with an eyepiece up top and the little objective down there and a light underneath? Is that the general picture?
A little bit. So if you're imagining like an old school microscope that you've seen, I guess in old timey photos or something, it's a little larger than that. So it's not quite as small as the old timey microscopes, but it's still something you could easily just fit on your desk. I think the weight of it is somewhere between maybe, I want to say 16 to 20 pounds or so, which for microscopes is fairly lightweight. And so it's, it's something where if you have a desk, you could put it on a desk easily. It does have eyepieces, but I specifically get microscopes that have trinocular ports, which just means that you can attach a camera to a third eyepiece, essentially. So what I do is I take my Canon DSLR, a 6D Mark II, and I attach it through a specialty tube to the trinocular port. And so that's how I was able to film a lot of the microscopic creatures in high quality.
Okay. And I would imagine one of the other benefits from LED is that it's cooler, because my recollection of the lights under the old fashioned microscopes was that they were hot.
Yeah.
And when you focus that little hotness on little critters, they don't like it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, there's, you know, worrying about the warming up your specimens, but also just adjusting the lamp and the lighting source. So prior to having this microscope, I had I believe like an AMSCOPE inverted microscope, and it had an halogen bulb. And whenever you needed to adjust the bulb so that you could get rid of some of the lighting artifacts, like you'd burn your hand. It was like really just miserable to use. And you have to worry about, you know, popping a bulb if you move it around too much or if you bang it up. So for me, being a field microscopist and wanting to be someone who goes out into the field in Antarctica or other places around the world and film all the microscopic animals, I really need something that has a high build quality so that it can get sort of knocked around a bit, the LEDs so that you don't have to worry about heating up too much and bulbs and things like that. And just sort of a general like ease of use. So yeah, the Nikon E200 LED microscope with that is like really fantastic. And I even have a fluorescent attachment to it so that I can actually shoot kind of fluorescent lasers at these creatures to see if they kind of glow in the dark, so to speak. And that's LED as well. And it's only really recently that you've been able to get fluorescent attachments to microscopes that are LED, as opposed to using like an arc lamp, which is really a huge pain and definitely not field safe to use.
Right. So if this Nikon 200 is sort of and it's $2,000 and it's kind of professional level, mm-hmm. is there like a Nikon 100 for half the price? Is there kind of like an amateur version of LED microscopes, maybe by not by Nikon, but by a Chinese company?
That's a really good question. So there's a lot of different options out there. I'm sure with Nikon, they might have an even cheaper version. Technically with the E200, I think they view it as like a student learning microscope for like university level students. Yeah, no, I know. They have a different concept of like accessible. So I think Nikon probably has even lower level ones, but you can get, you know, kids microscopes off of Amazon, fairly cheap. And also one that I like that's like a tiny proper microscope is a Bolli Optics inverted microscope that's a portable field microscope. And that one uses just a little tiny LED light to look at samples with, and it's battery powered and it fits in the palm of your hand. And, but it gives you the optical quality, that you have with a proper microscope. So that one's around $600, but again, you can get even cheaper, like kids microscopes on Amazon. And if you're just wanting to like look at water bears and, you know, tardigrades and nematodes and all sorts of stuff in your own garden, you can totally see like great stuff, with much cheaper microscopes.
I know that there was, kind of a variety of microscopes that you didn't even look through directly. It was just, they were all on a screen. Like there was I guess the eyepiece would just be a sensor of some sort, and that you would have the optical business end that you would put near the subject you were looking at. And then you would just go to like your phone or a screen or something. Do you have any experience with those kinds of things?
Yeah, so that's actually how I set mine up. So I've got the trinocular port that I mentioned where I've got my Canon attached to it. And then I connect that Canon over to my MacBook Pro and I pull up whatever Canon's sort of remote shooting software is. I think it's like EOS Utility. And that allows me to then just have a screen. So anything that's showing up on the microscope is getting ported immediately to my laptop. So it's kind of actually funny. The other day I was talking with someone and they wanted to have a bunch of photos of me like looking through the microscope, you know, like the traditional, like I'm here with my microscope and I'm looking down the binoculars. And, but I didn't really have any because I'm usually actually looking just at my computer screen when I'm searching for things.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, so this is a great tool. And, is there a maximum, I don't know, size, resolution, amplification, or magnification, I guess that's the word I'm looking for, that this does? Or am I, is that the right way you measure things, by amplification or magnification?
Magnification, yeah. So it depends on the objectives you get. The objectives are essentially the lenses that attach into the microscope itself. And so for me, I've got 4 to 100 objectives on my microscope. So that means that if I'm using the 100 objective on my microscope and then my eyepiece or my camera adapter is also like usually the standard is like 10 magnification. So that means you're getting 10 magnification times the 100 magnification of the objective, which gives you an effective 1,000 magnification. So I have that, but the limits are really the limits with light microscopy. So you're going to be able to see, for instance, with 1,000 magnification, you'll be able to see bacteria. You know, they're not very interesting, but you can see them. But you're not going to be able to, for instance, to see viruses and things that are that much smaller because they're smaller than the wavelength of color, as a lot of people have been learning in light. So that means that you need a different type of microscope to actually see them.
Right. So 1,000, if you could do 1,000, that should be plenty.
Oh, yeah.
For optical microscope.
Yeah.
You can't expect any more than that.
Yeah, essentially, like what I'm using when I'm looking at tardigrades is I'm typically using like 100 magnification. If I want to look at bacteria, I'll use 1,000 magnification. And so that just means like a 10x objective versus 100x objective.
Right. Okay. All right. Great. So what's another tool in your tool belt that you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I mean, so I've got a couple of things that are related to microscopy on my list. One is instead of using a Canon camera with a microscope, I often use a lab cam, which is a really great thing that attaches to an iPhone that allows you to actually just pop your iPhone into the eyepiece of most microscopes. And why I really like specifically lab cam is because it uses an actual like machined metal that you can actually sort of just dip right into any eyepiece of any microscope for the most part. Like every major name microscope and even off-brand ones too use one of two standard sizes typically in their eyepieces. So having an actual machine piece of metal that allows you to sort of dip it into an eyepiece means that you get like perfect quality, you know, photos and videos, anything that you want to shoot off of your iPhone from any microscope. And why that's really great is if you're someone who, for instance, you get to visit other people's microscopes or you visit other labs or things of that nature, it means that pretty much you always have a camera no matter what microscope you're using, and you don't have to rely on really outdated cameras that are often attached to microscopes. And the other good thing about it is that there's a lot of 3D printed hardware out there that attaches to microscopes. But I've found that because they often use plastic only and don't really use machine pieces of metal, that they don't fit that well and they're really finicky.
Mm-hmm. So if we were to describe this is, you're going to be using the camera in your phone to photograph through a microscope. And if you just put the phone right over the end of the microscope eyepiece, it doesn't work. Is the idea that you need another piece of glass or lens in between the two to kind of focus it?
Yeah.
And this holder, the metal holder, is something that both holds your phone like on a shelf and then attaches itself with this extra piece of glass to the microscope, top of the microscope. Is that right?
Somewhat. So if you imagine like binoculars, imagine like being able to pop the lens out of one of your binoculars and instead insert your own lens attached to your phone. That's kind of what this does.
So it replaces the eyepiece.
Yeah. So it replaces the eyepiece. So the vast majority of microscopes, you can remove an eyepiece so that you can do a lot of work to sort of make the microscope lighting the way that you want it to be. So this allows you to pop out the eyepiece, but instead of like calibrating your microscope, you're popping out the eyepiece so that you can actually put in your own lens that's perfectly attached to your phone. And so you can get a perfect image. Otherwise, it's really difficult to hold your phone in place to get a quality image from those.
But going back then to the idea of just looking at things on a screen, could you get a microscope and only pay for the objective lens and forget about the eyepiece lens and just put in this thing in your phone?
I don't know of any microscopes that would be sold without eyepieces is the problem.
I'm looking for a bargain here with that $2,000.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, certainly like with lab cam, like, so lab cam is somewhere around like $240, $250. So again, it's something that I wouldn't recommend unless it's something that you're doing a lot or you're intending to do a lot. Because otherwise, yeah, it's way overpriced. You know, as I said, there's a lot of 3D printed solutions out there that if you're just wanting to use it like once or twice, then I would go with a cheaper option that's not as good. But if you need something to like work perfectly every time and just be no hassle and you visit different microscopes all the time, then this is actually really worth it.
But that's a great tip, as you should, you know, do a search for, I mean, you can even print it out yourself, a 3D file for what would you call it? iPhone.
Like an eyepiece adapter. Yeah.
Adapter for a microscope. Okay. Yeah. And that's a great tip. Okay. So then tell us about another pick of yours.
Yeah. So I guess that all sort of funnels into my laptop of choice, which is my MacBook Pro 16-inch that I recently purchased. And I specifically, I'm both like embarrassed and proud to say that I got the 8 terabyte MacBook Pro because it's ridiculous, but
whoa,
because I do so much video work and this is literally my only laptop. It was really worth it. And I specifically didn't purchase a laptop for 8 years. So I had the very first MacBook Pro Retina from 2012. And I waited 8 years on that laptop and it still was working great to purchase a new one. But I do so much work in video now that having 8 terabytes as my main computer and having it in a laptop is just really fantastic.
Are you a Adobe Premiere or a Apple Final Cut Pro?
I am Adobe Premiere.
And I have a question for someone who uses a lot of video. Is there a equivalent of a Lightroom for video? Lightroom is a is an organizer. It just organizes your pieces, all your photos before mm-hmm. you process them. And are there tools that you have for organizing all the video clips and things that you make before you actually move them into Premiere?
That is a really good question. And actually, I want to know the answer to that myself. Okay.
Well, the answer is no. All right.
Yeah, like I know some people use like DaVinci for like color grading and everything, but for organization, I actually don't have anything. And the story behind that is when I came back from Antarctica, I had 500 videos, I think of 500 microscope videos and 400 videos of the actual expedition, like separate files. And I tried to keep them as organized as I could while I was there. But even when I came back, I am not kidding. I spent two months like reorganizing all 900 of those videos. And I was doing it through file names and stuff like that. So I'm probably doing it like in the most archaic way possible.
Yeah. I mean, one of the advantages of like Lightroom is that you can classify things virtually in many different collections.
Exactly. Yeah.
And if you work on a piece in one collection, it changes it in all the other collections at the same time. So yeah, that kind of advanced organization I've been hunting for, I thought maybe you might know. So are there other kind of tools related to your work with video in terms of either not just filming it, but as you say, processing it or even in some ways uploading it or sharing it? What have you, are there tools that you use on a frequent basis for that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for the most part, it really, in terms of processing it all, it really is Premiere and then YouTube. In terms of actual shooting, you know, I'm using a couple of LED panels and a Shure digital microphone. I've been trying lately to shoot my YouTube videos using just my iPhone XS.
How does that go?
It's pretty good. You know, I can see, you know, there's like a little bit more clarity I could probably pull out of if I was shooting with my Canon instead. But the benefit of using my iPhone hooked up to a microphone and then also hooked up to Filmic Pro, which is a recording app where you can sort of set a lot of camera settings through the app and sort of override Apple's default recording.
Oh, wait. So you use an app on your phone instead of the camera app?
Yes.
To actually film.
Yeah. And that's really important because if you just use the camera app to film, I believe Apple still to this day only does like autofocus. So you might have the camera actually searching for focus a lot when you're just wanting to lock in focus. So
that's cool.
So Filmic Pro, I won't say it's like amazing. It's definitely buggy and it took a lot of like figuring out what it does and doesn't work with. But once I got it working with, you know, my microphone and everything, it means that I can film a YouTube session and it's all just saved on my phone. The audio is already synced. There's just a huge ease of use to it once you get around the bugs that is really great.
And do you also, when you're using your iPhone to film, do you also mount it like on a tripod or a hand rig or something to make it more stable?
Yeah, I've got like a little phone clip that attaches to a standard tripod. So that's what I use to sort of stabilize it.
Okay. And then you move it off of the phone into Premiere on your super duper 8 terabyte supercomputer on your lap to do all the processing and editing.
Yeah.
Does anybody attempt to edit things on their phone?
I'm sure that people do. It would probably make me cry if I tried doing that. I mean, I will say, you know, the first, when I was starting out on YouTube a few years ago, the very first like one or two videos I did, I edited in iMovie. And I know that's not editing on your phone. It was iMovie on my laptop. But I think there are a lot of people where that's a perfectly fine way to start out because Premiere, so many of these tools, it's like, I spend so much time with them, but I can't really sing their praises because they just make things more difficult than they need to be.
They can be infuriating for sure.
Yeah. Like, I mean, Premiere to this, Premiere is like overwhelming. And then the community around it is overwhelming because a lot of times you're like, how do I do this very simple thing? And then it's like, well, here's 10 different videos that are 20 minutes long each that you have to listen to figure out. It's like, I wish people would do more written tutorials for things because it takes you forever to learn how to do every new thing all the time, even if you've used it for years.
And I have another complaint about that, which is like particularly the Adobe products, whether it's Photoshop or InDesign or Premiere or Illustrator. And that is, sometimes a very basic thing, like just when I open up the program for the first time or the second time, it doesn't look like what I see on their screens. And like there's some fundamental elemental difference of like whether they're showing the menus or not and just how to get there is like they just assume that you're at a certain point and to go back way back to the beginning that's really they just don't count for that, so there's a disconnect there. That's just a pet peeve, but
yeah. My pet peeve is grayed out menu options and they don't explain why they're grayed out. You should be able to hover over the grayed out thing and say the reason it's grayed out is because blah blah blah.
But all this said, you know, since the pandemic and shelter in place and everything got kicked off, Adobe Premiere is probably the tool I'm spending the most time with day to day. For better or worse.
So you have one other maybe a less high-tech tool that you is a favorite of yours. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so it's a favorite notebook that I have that really just works very well for me. It's the Nemosyne 182 gridded notebook. And it's, you know, for all the tech and everything, I am actually pretty analog. You know, I started off in analog photography, and I just like physicality and a lot of things. So I still write most everything. So I use this notebook as a to-do list, as a habit tracker, as a brainstormer. There's something I like about it because it's more of a horizontal format notebook, and it just feels that much more different. And so I can really just think about things differently. And I don't know, for people who are very physical like that, I guess that might make sense. It's hard to put into words, but this notebook has probably been the most successful notebook I've had in terms of purchasing it and then actually using it and not just admiring it. And it's got like a ringed bound to it. So it means that you can just store a pen with your notebook at any given time really easily. So things like that I really appreciate because I do write down most everything that I'm doing.
And you prefer this over some of the other versions like the Moleskines or others because of that spiral or not spiral bound, but the wire bound version of it?
I think so. You know, I've got a ton of Moleskines. I'm one of those people who just like is like, that's an amazing notebook. I'm going to buy it. And then I'm never going to use it because it has to have the perfect stuff in it.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's just like aspirational notebooks. I totally have that problem. And I guess that's why I like this one because something
it's less
about,
precious.
It's less precious, but at the same time, it's still a little bit precious. So I also use, you know, yellow notepads, which I saw Bonnie Burton had listed as one of her tools in a previous podcast on here. And I use those when they're like, I want something completely not precious. But this thing is that nice balance between being a little bit precious and special, but not feeling like it has to be like the most perfect notebook. And the sheets actually have tearaways on them really easily. So something about it just clicked for me.
And you're partial to the grid.
Yes.
Blank or lined.
Yes. Yeah. I like my grids. Like this one's gridded. My probably all-time favorite is a dot grid, but this is gridded and I love it all the same.
Yeah. They make a nice little to-do list booklet too that I picked up.
Oh, smaller than the fiber.
Yeah. Yeah. They're really nice.
Yeah.
So,
okay, great.
So Aria, we just have a couple of minutes left, but tell us about the book that you put out, I think it was a couple of years ago, What's It Like in Space? Stories from Astronauts Who've Been There.
Yeah, so this was just a really fun book to put together. It's stories from astronauts about their time in space, but it's more about like the embarrassing, funny, silly times that they've had in space, things that make it a lot more relatable about, you know, you spend your whole life trying to go to space and then you're there and then you do something and you're totally like scared someone's going to make fun of you or you do weird experiments with bodily fluids. So it's kind of just a short and sweet book about the delightful, fun aspects of space as told from over a dozen different astronauts, which I think is important because a lot of times we're given a very singular narrative about what it's like in space and how people feel about it and how it's either the greatest thing or not. And I really wanted to show a variety of different narratives about what people thought about their time in space.
It's great. It's put out by Chronicle. And as I recall, it's got really nice illustrations in it too.
Yes. Yeah. It's definitely like a cute, small coffee table book.
Yeah.
Was there any particular story that was the most surprise to you or something that you really had not expected to hear?
I mean, one that, you know, is there were a lot of things that were surprising. But one thing I think I always keep in mind is that one of the astronauts I spoke to talked about how if you ever go into space, make sure that you go for longer than 4 days, because the first 4 days are absolutely miserable because your face gets really, really bloated and you just feel terrible. And it's because all of your blood gets equalized. So instead of most of your blood being held below your head, like it is here on Earth, all of your blood all of a sudden is everywhere, which means you have a lot more blood content in your face and in your head than you're used to having. And it takes your body about 4 days to kind of shed some of that excess blood volume that you no longer need. And once it does that, you feel much better and much more comfortable. So I thought that was kind of surprising because a lot of people are talking about, you know, these space tourist ventures, and they might only be in space for an incredibly short period of time. So it's a good thing to keep in mind, I guess.
Right. When you're scheduling your space vacation, make sure that it's more than 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
There was a video, or I guess it's kind of a video movie. I think it was called A Year in Space.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that surprised me, it was about that one guy with a twin brother.
Yeah, Scott Kelly and Mark Kelly.
Exactly. The thing that surprised me about that documentary was how jumbled, and I wouldn't call it junky, but how filled with stuff the entire space lab was, you know, the space station.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just basically every available surface is covered with gear. And the kind of typical image of space you have of the streamlined, empty, stark, clean spaces is totally
doesn't
wrong.
Exist.
It's the other way around. It's like the hoarders, it's like the hoarder's paradise. It's like everything is stored there.
Yeah, that might drive me a bit crazy while I'm up there. Yeah.
So you're kind of like you're sleeping in your gearbox.
All your junk. Yeah.
All your junk.
Yeah.
Well, if people want to find out more about you and what you're up to, where do they go?
So if you're interested in seeing all the microscopic critters I filmed in Antarctica and having, I guess, an easier link to see my Antarctic expedition, you can go to lifeundertheice.org. So that's a kind of a virtual microscope, giving you the feeling of being able to look at all the microscopic critters through the microscope and sort of pan around and find new ones. And then if you click on the About page, then it'll show links to the videos of the expedition itself. Otherwise, people can find me on YouTube just under my own name, Ariel Waldman. And I'm kind of just all over the internet under my own name.
Cool. Ariel, thanks so much. This has been really fun talking to you, catching up with you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Hey, everybody. It's Mark from the Cool Tools Podcast. I want to thank you for being a listener to Cool Tools. And I also would like to let you know about our Patreon page. If you would like to support the Cool Tools Show, as well as our video channel, the website, and all the newsletters that we do, you can go to patreon.com/cooltools, that's just one word, Cool Tools, and pledge any amount you want. You could even pledge $1 a month. Every little bit helps. We have editors, we pay for transcribing costs, we pay our reviewers. Every bit of money that you contribute goes towards supporting the show. I'd like to give a shout out to our supporters of the Cool Tools Podcast. This week, I'd like to thank the following Patreon supporters: Bill Schuler, Bob Kay, Ryan Pelly, Carl D. Patterson, Chad Cosby, Chris Wieland, Chris Weirstook, Craig Tooker, Dan O'Brien, Dean Putney, Danelle Cunningham, Evan Barker, Graham Medlin, Hans Riesbeck, Helen Hegedus, Jerry Kearns, Jim Lesko, Jim Spofford, John Pollock, John Burdenbaugh, Keith O., Ken Altman, Les Howard, Lauren Bast, Mock Nerd, Malton Make, Mark Goebel, Matt Gromes, Michael Douglas, Michael Jones, and Michael Pecorini. Thanks to all of you for supporting the Cool Tools Show. We really appreciate it.